Hello everyone, welcome back to Shovel VR, dig deeper into virtual reality. Still a working title, podcast name, we don't know what's happening, but yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed the first podcast. Joining us for the second podcast is the same cast and crew. First up, we have Christoph Izbeski. Christoph Izbeski, and the second is Peter Litkov.
Hey there.
It's Izbeski, but that's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. We all have such weird names. And my name is Azad Balabanian. And we're here for our second episode. Hi guys, how has everyone been?
Oh well, it's like New Year's Eve is over. It's the new year started. A lot of news coming, a lot of news came, a lot of stuff happened.
Mm-hmm. New year, new man, new waiting for virtual reality.
A year. It's a year where everything will be launched. Like, finally, we reach this year where everything will be magic with unicorns and sparkles. Right?
I sincerely hope, first of all, I will receive my CyberRiff one day. One of those days this year.
What are you waiting for?
CyberRiff, the omnidirectional.
This omnidirectional. Yeah.
Oh man,
you know, like Omni from the US, but from Vienna.
How much was the Kickstarter for that? Or
oh, the Kickstarter was very cheap. It was like $600, I think.
Oh, really?
But when you pre-order it right now, you have to pay like 1.5k for the non-commercial version,
really?
Maybe 6k for the commercial one.
Is that what you're paying for this?
We cannot tell you that, but it's ordered through university, and we had to hunt them down. And actually force them to give us a contract. Nice guys, by the way.
Very interesting. Speaking of universities and whatnot, I found a Twitter account of this one random HoloLens, this woman that works at Microsoft, and she works with HoloLens, and they're trying to find communities and people. I think they're trying to give out HoloLens to. Not sure if they're trying to give it, or at least to give access to. And I've reached out to her about my lab, and I'll be talking to her later today. You guys should definitely... I can link it to you as well.
There was an announcement from Microsoft that they have some HoloLenses to give out to the academic institutions.
Is that right? Oh, well, they had a little thing like a month or two ago, and it was kind of like you have to apply, and there was like a very long application process.
Exactly.
So this was a bit different. This was just like one-on-one through person. So. Maybe something can come of it, and I can do some augmented reality research, which would be really cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I was very happy about that.
Well, but there are more exciting news to come, right?
Let's dive into it, guys.
Exactly. First of all, the new Oculus is going to be on pre-sale.
Pre-sale tomorrow.
January.
That's right.
Yes.
January 6th, tomorrow at 8 a.m. When the news came out today by Lockheed Palmer that they're releasing they're giving away the CV1 to everyone that has a DK or that ordered a DK1 through the Kickstarter. What a fantastic thing to just throw out there. Like, honestly, that's a major, major move from Oculus.
Definitely.
And
it's just 6,000.
Wait, was that right? They only had 6,000 DK1 sold?
Yes.
Oh.
I mean, they had more, but I think on Kickstarter, they had 6,000 people who were baking.
Mm. That's cool. I didn't know that number, actually. That's cool. This is all building off of Lucky Palmer tweets a lot, and he was talking about, sometimes he goes on, you know, like 5-6 tweet rants about, you know, something about whatever's happening. And he was talking about how the first generation or even the first two generations of VR headsets are going to be very heavily subsidized by the companies that are making them. So trying to find profit and, you know, work for profit is not their main goal. And I think this move really shows that. It's like, you know, they could charge for everyone, but they're like, no, these guys, you know, really backed us in the beginning, let's get them back. They'll, you know, create more hype and more people. So
you know that there are two games that will come in the bundle?
Yeah. Oh, the great
Eve Valkyr and the Lucky's Tale.
Two very different games from both art style and also gameplay, because one is first-person view and cockpit, and the second one is a third-person, floating over your own character. So I think that shows off like the versatility of VR games like really well, just right out of the box.
Yes. Maybe what's interesting, but I guess for our audience it's a little bit too late, there will be also an Reddit MMA on the January 6th at 6 p.m. Pacific time, where he will answer questions regards to Oculus.
Oculus will?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious to see that. Oh, that's tomorrow, right?
Yes,
Wednesday.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So I'll be mashing my F5 at 8 a.m. to get the CV on, even though I don't have a personal computer to actually run it on.
Well.
But I still want one, so.
I guess if you don't order it now, the next chance will be quite late.
That's what I'm thinking, I need to have it day one, make sure it's all good and ready, and then I can buy an NVIDIA VR-ready computer that they've been hyping.
And hey, you will get an Xbox controller for free.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
Isn't that amazing?
So, in terms of hardware, both HTC and Oculus showed off their latest and greatest hardware. So let's discuss those guys. So since we're talking about Oculus, let's talk about they showed off the new designs for the touch controller. They're all sleek. They're all new. They obscured all of the little tracker kind of white dots that were on them. I think those are the hand gestural trackers. And there's also, you guys, this is something new on the controller itself, and it almost looks like a mesh onto the left side on the top of your thumb. It could be a speaker. People are saying it's like some kind of like a ultrasonic sensor, which I don't think it is, but I don't know. Have you guys seen anything about that?
No.
No?
No, but it would be nice to have a small like bass speaker there that could create vibration.
Where have you seen it?
Here, I'll send you a picture of it, actually.
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, and there's just a lot of speculation as to like what it could entail.
I have to be honest, this whole speculation thing is like driving me crazy. Okay, we are making an amazing headset, but we are not telling you when we will sell it. Okay, we will tell you when we sell it, but we will not tell you how much it will cost. Like someone on Twitter was ranting, they will take some money from you and then later charge you more, but they won't tell you how much they will charge you later. It will go on and on. It's like crazy. So they're building up this intense feeling of, something magic is going to happen, they will sell it for, no one knows how much money and everyone's kind of waiting to click. It's interesting.
Mm.
I don't know. Suspicious.
Whatever works, we need to build a critical mass, I won't complain that they have some fishy marketing tricks as long as I will have my virtual reality game.
Yeah, I agree. So, where is the picture?
I found it. Give me a second. I'll send you guys a screenshot.
The funny part is when you will pre-order and buy the Oculus tomorrow, in fact, you won't get the touch controllers. You have to order.
I know, and I was kind of disappointed by that, and I can't fully explain why they're doing it. I'm sure it's a hardware and manufacturing issue. So if you look at the picture, guys, to the right of those buttons is that little mesh.
Exactly. It might be a microphone.
Oh, I see.
Like,
why would you need two? No, they already have a microphone on the HMD. So why would you need? Yeah, or at least that's what I. That's.
I thought they only have a headset. Like, I didn't know they have a microphone.
They should have a microphone, and that makes the most sense. But people were speculating at speakers on the controller. But why would you need speakers when you have headphones on? So who knows? Maybe it's just a little orientation thing so that you know how you're holding it, right? But
you have the buttons,
not that hard.
You can touch them.
Yeah. So that's the big. That's the biggest thing that Oculus has said this week so far, which isn't that big. And HTC, on the other hand, has shown off what their the Vive Pre was what they're calling it, not a DK2, a Vive Pre looks like, and it looks kind of like a sleeker, more modern version of what they had with the new controllers as well, and also the camera, the downward facing camera, which is supposed to help the chaperone system.
What exactly is the system? Can you tell a little bit more about it?
So I don't have a Vive, but I've actually used it a couple of times. The chaperone system is probably the thing that gives the Vive the edge over the Oculus, in my opinion. Although I think Oculus has a lot of great things. So using your controller when you first are setting up the Vive, you walk around the room, or at least you walk around the space that you can actually use for VR. So you know, since it's tracking, it's basically you're laying out borders. When you do that, it sets up these virtual borders, and you don't see these borders unless you actually get very close to them. And when you get close to them, you see this interesting little blue grid that pops up.
It's amazing, yeah. It's very
which is
nice.
Brilliant because you know that blue grid is where the wall is, and so you know if you touch that blue grid, that is the wall, and it's like 1-to-1.
Technically, it's not about the wall, but being out of the tracking range.
Technically, you're right. So, but sometimes it ends up being a wall, right? So what this camera is doing actually is, if you don't have a wall, if you have other objects in front of you, it's supposed to be picking up on those and then over putting, you know, seeing that in the chaperone system if you're getting too close to it. So it just gets rid of, you know, like falling on things, falling into people. So there's two this is very, very new, and I literally read it like 30 minutes before we started talking. And HTC, I don't think, has even had their event yet, and this is all coming from like a journalist that just tried it yesterday, and I'm writing up about it this morning. So the new chaperone system, I don't even know if they're even calling it that anymore. It looks a little bit different. They said it's not like the same grid. It's more detailed, like more high fidelity, like objects, which is cool. And then they also have a button now. If you press the menu button on the HTC Vive controller twice, it actually overlays the grid and everything just completely in front of you, so you can actually have the sense of like being. It's basically like a pass through, like a IR pass through, but like with a blue kind of matrix feeling, like without the actual matrix going down. That's the way I've heard the reporters talk about it, but I haven't seen the actual like visuals myself. But it's very interesting, and this is what the big breakthrough that they were hyping was.
It's very suspicious, I have to admit. So first of all, if I look precisely at the photo of the new HTC Vive, I see one camera. And if you say that you can kind of see what's in front of you, it's either an RGB camera or it's like Kinect, like, I don't know, Dev's camera. But with a Dev's camera, you can barely, you know, see what's in front of you in terms of color, just the structure. And I mean, it's true that, for example, Oculus has also made a number of computer vision acquisitions in January. No, not in January. I think they did it in like June or something, so or July. So they're both working on it. But I'm pretty sure that in terms of actually tracking objects in the room, you would need like at least two cameras, at least stereo vision or a normal RGB camera and a Dev's camera. And a Dev's camera definitely needs also an infrared emitter.
So, I don't know if you need both anymore, or at least that's what the tech kind of is suggesting, is that depth cameras and RGBs are kind of being integrated into one. So actually, Intel has something called the, I think, RealSense.
And, exactly, but they have two cameras there.
That is two cameras, you're right. I don't know. I'm guessing they're doing something. Maybe it does have two in it, and it's just one big housing that's a circle. That doesn't make sense, actually. I don't know why they would do that, but
It does look really huge. I mean, that's interesting. Like, if you really look close to it, just not just the whole of the camera, but there seems to be like a ring around it. So it might be actually the infrared emitter.
Oh. Yeah.
And then there's a camera in the middle. So technically, with the first Kinect, you would have two infrared cameras, I think, and one and light emitter, but I think you can do with certain technologies one infrared camera and one emitter and then just recalculate the position of it. Mm. Time of flight, it's called. It's really amazing.
Oh, you guys, that might be, sorry, my
computer. Yeah, but it's fine. We can filter it.
Okay, cool.
Technology can help. Yeah, okay, it's amazing. I'm really curious to see it actually in life. But what I really like are the new controllers from them. So they look like super spacey.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. I'm glad they're finally doing something that's more ergonomic, you know, yes, to the actual experience.
Are they a bit heavier than the previous ones? Or a second question, do they have some kind of armband that I can plug them to? Mm-hmm. Last time I had them in my hands, the previous ones, mm-hmm, they just felt highly dangerous in my I was afraid to hold them.
Yeah, so they have this thing you can put on your hand, like the Wii controller had, so you don't throw it on your TV.
The Oculus has that. Oh yeah, I see that the Vive.
HTC Vive has to it. They don't want to get sued, I guess. You saw so many destroyed screens.
All the TVs.
from the Wii, so I think they learned the lessons. Just glue it to the hand.
Well, the Wii's answer to that was putting a big fat condom on their controllers. If you guys remember that.
Yes,
the big weird gel looking condom thing.
Oh gosh, yeah, it was amazing.
First they started shipping the armbands together in the set of controllers for Wii.
Right.
And only after that, there was this weird thing.
By the way, if we talk about cameras and tracking, have you seen the news that Gear VR will have in a certain way hand tracking?
Yes, they have those interesting little. They look like money clips that go around your wrist or
exactly,
the palm of your hand.
Exactly.
Yeah. Still very experimental from the Samsung kind of like experimental places, but
it was super strange. Like I think a week ago or 1.5 week ago, I saw a video that was actually this system. It's called Ring, but I didn't know what it is because it was in Korean, so I just tweeted it. And then later I found out, it's Gear VR.
Yeah.
And it looks a little bit funky. Yeah, it's not steady, but okay. I mean, it's a prototype. And it's actually really cool. I mean, I've read some rumors about the new Galaxy S7. So it will be like still with a curved screen and stuff. So you might actually add a SD card back. But there was no particular interesting news regards whether it will be like better for VR or not. I mean, they're obviously putting a better processor in it, a better GPU and CPU. But the question is how, you know, whether they will actually keep the S7 as they had the S6 a VR phone, or they will launch something else like. I guess from their perspective, having a S7 as a VR phone is making sense because you can just sell more of them and, you know, people are happy. But I didn't saw like any special tweaks in the rumors on the phone for virtual reality, so it's interesting. Mm-hmm. But there were also some news that the Gear VR will finally have the recording back, so you can actually record the video. So a long time ago, you could actually stream the video from your Gear VR via the Chrome stick. Then some update came and broke it. So the only thing that was working was Miracast. I was using it on an exhibition. It was kind of really pain in the ass. And now apparently they are either going to fix this Chrome stick streaming and apparently also enable recording.
It's not only going to be enabled, but when the next SDK for Gear VR comes, you will have an obligation, the same way as to make the back button working, you will have an obligation to make a recording option.
Okay, the whole Twitch people will be happy.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously streaming is such a big industry nowadays that you really need to do that. But I think it goes beyond like actual live streaming, like having the screen display what you're seeing or having other people to be included in your VR experience is kind of like a very fundamental leg of VR. We really have to be building upon now. PSVR is really going to be banking on this because they can only support one system. or one VR headset per system, and PSVR is very oriented towards a lot of people. And so I'm sure there are going to be a lot of games coming out that, you know, people are going to be sitting there with controllers using the TV screen, doing things, you know, playing around with a person in VR in front of them. I'm curious to see what Oculus and HTC can do with something like that as well. But the having, including other people around you that aren't in VR into seeing what you're doing is going to be kind of crucial and very big.
How is PSVR different in that matter than other PC head-mounted displays?
I think inputs, right? Like having the control, multiple controllers. Like PCs is usually just for one person. So, but PlayStation can support up to four, or maybe even more.
You can connect more Xbox controller to a PC too.
Is that
yes? Okay. So,
before we
discuss the systems, just a short news: there are 36 million PlayStation 4 sold. And during Christmas, they apparently sold 5.7 million. Now, before we go on to the controller, Sengi, I mean, they have three times more systems out there that will support VR compared to PC, at least if you trust NVIDIA. Because NVIDIA was in a talk with VentureBeats actually speaking about the fact that there are maybe 13 million computers that are fast enough for VR. And this is like less than 1% of the PCs out there.
Did they include the other graphic cards that can do VR? NVIDIA's?
No, I think they spoke about both, which is interesting. And when you talk about like more controllers, I mean, in a certain way, you will have this rendering box for the PlayStation VR that will take care of the PC. And I guess, theoretically, you could have a game where someone has the VR headset on their head and someone second is, you know, interacting with the screen and helping them. Not sure if anyone will make it as a game. Would be very interesting.
Yes, there is already a pre-order on Steam for such a game.
Yeah, okay, Steam is not PlayStation, right?
Right.
Yes, but we've just spoke about that this is going to be a particular advantage of PSVR. That you will be able to do exactly that.
Yeah, okay, but you can technically do the same on the computer. I mean, the SDK from Oculus also can show you either something similar is on the Oculus or different on the screen. Mm. Now, the problem with both systems is you have like one HDMI output, right? So you have like one system support. You cannot connect two Oculi to your computer. I guess they will never support it. There's first of all not enough calculation power, and second of all, just not supported.
I can't wait till that is a thing, and I think maybe second time around is that's going to be a real thing. When you're standing in the same room with someone else in VR, and you know everything works out that you're in the same environment with another person, like exactly. That you can even touch him in like real life, actually touch him.
Yeah, touching.
Isn't that the idea of Oculus Touch?
True, but that's not. You're not in the same room. You don't have to be in the same room.
Okay.
I mean, okay, we can maybe go on to this Tesla suit that was just launched as a Kickstarter project.
Sure.
If you're speaking about the touching or the feeling of each other, who wants to speak about it?
Go for it. You can explain it to people that haven't heard much about this Tesla suit.
Okay, so they just launched a Kickstarter campaign, and I think the suit allows you for climate control inside it. It has haptic feedback. That I think works through vibration, right?
Yes, something like that, just all around the suit itself.
Yeah. It's very expensive, so I think the cheapest version of it.
It's like $1,500.
It's 1,200 pounds, which
pounds,
is like.
Pounds, right.
Yes, so which is 1,000. Yeah, 1,500, basically. Yeah.
Sorry.
Just a lot. I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think from a maybe research side or development side, this is something interesting to start with. Like
it's amazing. I mean, from the research side and you know, using it actually for serious business, it's amazing. I mean, okay, let's go a little bit out from the entertainment part and go into serious applications. When you have such a suit and you have someone who is a worker who is in a very complex environment, you know, repairing something or interacting with complex machines, and you actually can prove and teach him how to use those signals to feel things, like, you know, how the drone flies or how the machine is feeling, whatever. This is amazing. I mean, 1500, you know, it's not much for, you know, a suit for your employee to walk around and interact with complex stuff. And I mean, for military, it might be also quite interesting, or for police, or for whatever, whoever is, like, you know, needs quick and dirty information, you know, flowing in and out. I'm not sure how well you can read with it. So apparently there was a project. I don't have, unfortunately, a link for it, but people have put it some kind of tactile sensors, like vibromotors, I guess, on a person, and trained them to read with it.
Oh, yeah. That's I think that I was telling you about that. The David Eagle.
It was you who was talking about it, yes. And, I mean, it takes some training, but you don't have to go full-blown up reading. Maybe some certain information is enough, like, you know, go left, go right, or... Like, navigation is obviously a thing, but I guess you can show more. Where is the threat? Where do I need to put the gun? Where is something broken around
here? Let's talk about that. So, quick little summary of what that is. So, there's something called sensory substitution, which is kind of being explored in the research field now, where since your brain is such a plug-and-play kind of device, like every sense that goes to your brain is still the same language to the brain. It's the same action potentials, same electrical charges. So by the brain kind of really learn, if you keep doing the same thing to the brain, you know, giving it the same input, it starts to make a sense of what it is. So David Eagleman, this really interesting kind of neuroscientist researcher, he's running a Kickstarter project for this, and I think they got fully funded a couple months ago. It's called Vest, V-E-S-T, and it's essentially this vest that you wear that's supposed to help people, I think it's a OCR, like optical camera reading. It's supposed to read words and kind of put it in a tactile feedback to you so that you can actually understand the word. And over time, you'll actually like be able to understand words just by the feeling of the vest that it gives you. It doesn't have to be words. It could be for anything, right? Even sense direction where you guys are doing feel space. Do you want to talk about that? Or
The feel space project is a tactile navigation belt from the University of Osnabrück. Mm-hmm. It has been developed in the research of multisensory contingencies. We spoke last time about it, and we might, in some future podcast, have a very amazing guest who will explain it a little bit more.
That would be great.
Yes. But the belt is basically, you know, vibromotors around your waist, and you can go around it. Chris, can you maybe explain the difference between substitution and augmentation? I always mix it up.
Yeah, so the idea is that substitution is that you do not use one of the senses, but instead you use the same resources for the other. So with the blind people, they can hear better because they have resources that are left over from the fact that they can't see, so they can use it for hearing better or feeling more touch, so they can read Braille language.
So what are the two, substitution and...
And augmentation.
Augmentation, okay.
An augmentation idea is that you still have all your senses, but you get one more. So the idea of field space belt was that you are using tactile information and you get the signal about the cardinal directions. So from now on, you wear the belt every day for enough time, and then you will always know where the north is.
Right.
And just like birds, you would always have a sense of north, and that you would be your sixth sense, so to say.
Right. That's actually a very interesting kind of field. I've read a little bit about it before with weird kind of biohackers where they were putting magnets onto the, you know, subdermal, like right underneath their fingers. And what that was allowing them to do was actually over, you know, a month or two, they were actually starting to feel electromagnetic fields around electronic devices, which was very, very cool.
Amazing.
I heard it on a podcast like a while back, and he was interviewing one of these guys, and he said the next step actually they were thinking about is having some kind of a magnet that's like a compass kind of magnet that you put somewhere in your body, in your leg somewhere, that you'll always have this intrinsic sense of north, or, you know, of all the directions. Like, how interesting would that be? Or always have an intrinsic sense of where home is, that you can even literally turn towards it and start walking, and you know, even with your eyes closed, you'll know where that will be.
If you that's want to do that, off, you but... don't need to put anything under your skin. You just call Field Space and order one of their pelts.
Right.
And you have it
I
now.
I guess so. That's awesome. I'm glad that's a better alternative than subdermal magnets.
I'm not so glad. I think biohacking is amazing. I mean, in a certain way, when we think about the development of the technologies that happened since, you know, the last 100 years. So what we are basically being able to do right now is a child that is being born without the hearing working functionally, or, you know, without the hearing working at all, we can substitute it completely. The child will be as normal as it would be with normal hearing. And the funny thing is, we can, you know, in those very fancy hearing devices, and a lot of people who are using them are especially elderly people, they don't know it, those devices have a lot of features. For example, you can focus on voice. You're in a very loud environment. Yes.
Right? Even with the cochlear implants?
It depends. So, I mean, you have like different things there. So for a child, you have implants that are very great. For elderly people, you have those devices that are outside, but it doesn't really matter. Because what matters is the functionality that those devices give. And instead of just, making you hear better, those devices can make you hear better than a normal person. For example, you can record something and re-listen to it. You can enforce certain directions because the microphone is unidirectional, but you can like filter it out. So that means that those devices give you the possibility to be a better person. So this biohacking is initially not, you know, just, you know, I lost my arm, I will put a prosthesis on me, but I will have a better arm in a certain way and better eyes. And I mean, if we think about substitution of our eyes in later future, and there are prototypes of our retina that are in labs, so people are actually getting partly artificial eyes. So I don't have the proper resolution, but we are moving there. And if you, in terms of virtual reality, think about it, if you start, you know, being able to substitute our eyes, well, they're technical anyhow, you could just, you know, fake the signal.
Yeah.
And, you know, you wouldn't need any contact lens or anything. So,
you know, one person, quick little aside, there was another biohacker that's, I think, completely colorblind, or just, like, I don't, I mean, even I'm slightly colorblind, but, like, he's, I guess, you literally can't see colors. He's crazy. He put this big kind of dongle on top of his head.
Yes.
That it's kind of like this interesting camera that picks up on the colors in front of him and emits a certain tone. Like, if it's blue, it's like, eh. If it's yellow, it's like, eh. And then, like we said, neuroplasticity of your brain. The longer it hears something, it starts to understand it. So now, every time he's looking at something, whatever tone that thing is making, he knows actually what that color is associated with. Like, so he can tell you all these colors and things that he's looking at. Like, how interesting is that?
But that is not really the upper stuff of it. So you have actually research with people who are blind, and you have a grid of 300.300 pixels, and each pixel is coded by a slightly different tone, right? So each pixel is kind of coded by a different pitch. And the people, after 1, 2, 3 years of training, can see 300x300 pixels.
Whoa.
Just by listening.
So, like, the harmony, or not the harmony, like
yes,
the whole cacophony of sounds together.
Yes, yes, yes. Which is amazing. I mean, it takes training, but whoa.
Yeah, the potential for something like that is interesting.
Exactly. I mean, with colors, it's pretty neat. Like, I think everyone can very quickly pick it up. Like, I think you can very easily determine, like, the shape of an object with sound. Mm-hmm. Like, whether it's, you know, rotated, whether it's flat or something, which is very interesting. On the VR conference in Italy, where I have been with Chris, I saw a project where they actually, there was some kind of augmentation where they took a smartphone and it would look at those zebras, you know, those street lines that people can cross. I don't know how it's called in English.
Yeah, yeah.
It was called Project Zebra.
Yes. And it would basically... Exactly, and then it would basically, you know, beep if you would, you know, go off the zebra, and so it's very interesting.
That's So for blind, I'm like, I can't really find a link or anything, but
yeah.
Well, that sounds very promising, actually. Like,
definitely,
visual aid for the blind is probably like one of the biggest fields that could be, you know, worked on.
That's why this Tesla suit, even if it's like incredibly expensive, in a certain way, it's not. Because, I mean, the HealthSpace project is just a build, right? And me and a few colleagues always thought about, oh, let's build a West with Vibro motors. And I mean, okay, getting the West, putting Vibro motors is not that expensive, but actually making sure that there is an API and, you know, the thing is communicating and proper, like, we at university here have, you know, had always problems with techniques that regards the bailout because it was a prototype, right? We have been doing it for research, and sometimes a Vibro motor breaks. You're just not buying off the shelf equipment. And even if you do, like, you're not in manufacture, right? You don't have this quality of grade when you do it, you know, 12 devices for research. And if this Tesla suit will actually, you know, jump off and will be, you know, a very successful project, they might be, you know, very big.
Yeah, I'm reading more details about this Tesla suit right now that we can kind of spout off to people. So it's a 52-channel prototype. That's the second version that they're trying to make. Exactly. Is the 52-channel prototype.
From 16 to 54, like depending on how much money you throw in.
Right. And it's interesting. It has its own quad-core 1 gigahertz processor and a gig of RAM and a 10,000 milliamps battery. And it has its own proprietary operating system called Tesla OS, but it's interesting. It can actually, I think it said it could change 30 degrees of temperature within there. Like,
nice.
So 30 degrees Celsius, I'm guessing, or maybe Fahrenheit because that's a bit smaller. But it literally like feeling, and the videos and the things that they have already is like, it seems pretty promising. Like they have some UK celebrities and things in there, and they're just, you know, talking about like, whoa, like I just felt someone hugging me through this suit. you know, these are just some simple applications of the tech, but this is definitely going places. It won't be the only one for sure. Like if they're doing things like this and it's already accessible, then you'll see a lot more.
I'm really like, I don't know what to think about it, because on one side I'm like super amazed by this project and I wish them a lot of luck. On the other hand, I just I'm afraid they won't be able to finance themselves, because I mean, sure, 1500 is a lot, but if they don't produce a lot of them, and I mean not a lot,
then they'll die.
Buy such as they will die. Yeah. So
yeah.
Maybe I should bake them.
It's at least. That's the problem with a lot of Kickstarter things, right? Like every Kickstarter that I've even thought about kind of funding, like I end up going into the comments and looking, and then everyone is complaining like, hey, where's my this? Where's my that? Like, you know, like it's pretty hard to actually, especially from coming from a hardware perspective, it's very hard to make hardware and to actually it be a successful thing. But at least this is an interesting thing to look into, because like they're using electromuscular stimulation to do all of this, and so, you know, let's call it a case study and to keep our eyes on this kind of a technology. Cool. So we can kind of, we were already kind of talking about research already.
Exactly.
We can kind of keep going into.
One last thing, maybe the SMI foveated rendering. You think it's worth talking about it?
That's definitely.
One last news. As far as I have understood, the SMI, which is a company that usually does eye tracking for research, that also have an eye tracker that fits in the Oculus. It fits for the Oculus. It usually cost about how much was it?
It's like $10,000. Like it was kind of absurd.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. It was like super expensive. And what they announced is the foveated rendering that they want to build in the Oculus Rift. Chris, you still there?
Yes.
can you talk a little bit about the technology, and then I will comment on it.
The idea is. About something that anybody that knows about how the lenses in Oculus work and all that stuff is dreaming about. Because the idea is to render only the part that you actually look at.
It's only about, I think, 20 to 30 degrees around your fovea.
So it's actually 15 by 15 degrees.
Okay,
where you, where you can clearly read text and all those things.
Can you restate the degrees again?
15 by 15 degrees.
Okay.
And so the idea is that you would render with the full power, the full resolution, the 20 degrees in the middle. The next 40 degrees would be rendered only by, or the next part, I don't remember how much of those degrees, would be rendered with 60 to 80% of resolution.
Exactly, no.
And so the farther
The middle will be full resolution, the area around it will be 60, and the area around it, so very peripheral, will be 20.
Yes.
And not to, so just anyone is being confused by this, it's not that, you know, you're just taking the video and then you're changing, you know, and you're making the middle most high res, that middle is always following where you're looking. So exactly. That's why they're using the eye trackers, is whenever you look even in the top left of the corner, that'll be the most high res, you know, part of the screen, and then around it will be blurred out. And yes, this way, not only do you kind of cut back on processing power, which is a very big issue with, you know, VR, because you're doing dual rendering, it's also can simulate depth of blur, like depth of field blur. That, so if you look at things that are closer, things behind you, behind that object, are going to be blurred out. And that's actually how your vision works. So it's coming closer to what you're actually supposed to see.
Zara, I'm a little bit suspicious whether you can really actually track with the eye tracker they have the depths where you're looking at. Like, you definitely...
Well, it's a 3D space. I mean, if the object is in a 3D space, so if you're looking at an object behind
Yes, you can simulate. So, you can do some nice tricks, definitely.
Yeah.
Actually, that's not the goal of the eye tracker, because eye tracker can track your eyes only in 2D space.
It depends. There, we have actually with
Chris eye tracker itself.
Settle down, boys.
Dude, the eye tracker itself can track you only on two dimensions. What we've seen in USA was actually electrodes tracking your eye movements.
Which is
a different technology, by far different technology, because they created some smart algorithms in San Diego that could recognize from the electrode signal around your eyes the information about accommodation of your eye.
So literally not even needing an eye tracker, but to pick up the electrical signals coming to your eye.
Yes,
exactly. That, okay, so that's a little bit further off than like what we have currently. So the eye trackers, I think, is going to be probably included within the next Oculus. I mean, don't quote me on that, but that's definitely something they're looking into.
I wish.
You know, what if you have all these sensors integrated into the kind of the foam of the Oculus, where not only is it picking up on your eye, that electrode thing kind of brings about two things. Not only does it know where your eyes are looking at, but you said the accommodation.
Yes.
It's picking up the, so yes, what that accommodation is, for people that don't know, it's actually the lens of your eye and how much the lens is kind of extending outwards or kind of going back inwards towards a concave thing. So that's how your eyes actually focus onto a near thing or a further thing. Like, the further out an object is, the flatter the lens in your eyes gets.
And that's the ring muscles there that basically does the job.
And whenever you get old, it's myopia that whenever you get old, your lens actually hardens and you can't flex it as much, so you can't see things, you know, that are closer to you or whatever. So that's kind of the electrical signals that it's picking up to see, to know even where in space it's looking. That is very interesting, but still like a little bit further, still very in research mode.
Interesting point. Those electrodes that we've seen have not been in Oculus, but in Gear VR.
Yes. But you can technically put them in Oculus. Cool. Yeah. Yes. But when we come back to the press release from SMI, so, I mean, first of all, the eye trackers I have been using so far, when you would get one for 10,000, would just have 60 hertz. And this one that they want to put in the HDMIs would have 250 hertz, which is good news for researchers. The next part is that, in a certain way, they claim that you can, you know, render 4K, 8K, or 11K when you do this foveal rendering, which is sounding very amazing and technically is even possible. And I want to remind that there was a Kickstarter project called FoveVR, right?
It's still happening.
I actually put some money on it and I'm still waiting for it. I hope those guys will succeed. They're doing exactly this, but both the eye tracker and the headset themselves. But I guess SMI will just rely on a headset from Oculus or someone else. Now, the thing is, what makes me a little bit suspicious about it is, first of all, the eye tracker from SMI that was previously sold for the DK1 or DK2 would be like 10,000. And you get your DK1 or DK2, you send it to them, they upgrade it, and the next version of Oculus comes, you're doomed. So they're not just not like, you know, plug and play. Mm-hmm. And here, they are offering a very amazing technology, but you need to support it. I mean, you know, when games are usually the one only case that are actually really suffering from, you know, calculation of power, because in industry, you don't care how it looks. It needs to look fine, but you don't really care about the perfect lighting, perfect shadow, or some kind of dust effects. You just want the person to, you know, to look at a house and model it. But in games, you kind of want to have this amazing feeling, oh yeah, it's cool. And like, who in their normal mind will get something for it? And I think they will charge a lot of money for it. You know, they won't just sell it for 200, right? It will be like a few thousand. Who in their mind, after investing 1.5K in the computer, maybe 500 or 400 or whatever it is in the Oculus, then in the games that are not supporting it will also buy the system. So, I mean, it's amazing that they're doing it. It's cool that they have this press release, but I don't see how this technology will, from them, like, especially from SMI's wife, accept that Oculus actually builds it in. Because as much as it's amazing, as much as everyone is pretty sure this has to be done, I don't particularly understand why SMI is going out with this press release. I mean, it would be interesting if they would be putting it in, you know, mass production headset. But right now they're just saying, okay, we have an eye tracker. Well, okay, we knew it before. And you can track the eye. And, well, if you adjust the SDK.
Yeah, it's nothing which new. Actually,
yeah, yes. And they don't even tell you how to adjust the game and how to adjust the SDK to it. Like, we don't even know if the SDK from Oculus supports this rendering, right? I mean, that's kind of funny. Yeah.
What do you have to say, Peter? What are you itching to say? Or sorry about that, Chris.
So,
your guys' voice is hard sometimes. Sorry, go ahead.
The important new thing is that only by having 240 refresh rate, you can do this for VR rendering. It's not about sciency part. It's about actually processing in the right time and synchronizing. So only when you are above 230 or 40 refresh rate, you can do for VR rendering. Second of all, what you really pay for in SMI is not hardware, but it's a software, an API for it. So,
yeah, okay.
And you pay so much because they have usually a very individual solutions. So up until now, there were no hundreds upon hundreds of people who were buying their solution. Therefore, they had to sell it for a lot of money. So if they say sell five of them, it still pays off to them.
Well, but there is no mass market they will hit. And even if they hit it, they have no particular experience with the mass market.
Do you remember when we first time talked to the Oculus guy on Gamescom? What we asked him if Oculus is planning to put eye tracker there. And what he did was laughed in our faces and asked why would we do it in our right mind.
Well, who knows? That could have just been a rep, like a sales rep or something. But
yes, exactly.
I don't think anyone is discounting the big you know, how good it would be to have an eye tracker in there.
That was 2-3 years ago.
Yeah,
then
exactly.
The talking started and the idea started to pop out. Now
they didn't even have positional tracking back then.
Exactly. So
well,
I would not discount the idea that we need eye tracker. And at the beginning, SMI has to prove the concept. You know, they have to show
to whom?
To someone, maybe the Void. You know, the Void is doing their own hardware for everything. And so, yes, they will have their own position tracking, their own head-mounted display, their own hand controllers, some gun, I think,
suits,
all kinds of stuff.
Let me just explain what that is. The Void, for people that don't know, it's just a little VR kind of like experience that you can walk through. It's a real warehouse that they built, these mazes and things that you can put on this. It's a laptop game. It's a gaming laptop backpack and their own headset and their own gun basically that you're holding. And then you and your friends walk through this maze. You're wearing a VR headset and it overlays basically an alien world onto like the silly maze. So anyway, continue. with eye tracking.
Yeah, so there could be the one, the first one to be convinced, because since they are doing their own hardware anyway, and they will have at the beginning their own free games that are designed for their hardware only, they can afford eye tracker there for their next gen of games. Then there could be some art productions that can afford a little more money and have their own solution. So at the beginning, you need to convince a small group that will actually create some kind of content with it to show other people that it's worth it. When your market is growing, then your price can decrease. Mm. And then imagine the industry company like Audi, you know? For them, there could be some use of this eye tracker, and then they will pay this money. If you convince them that it will increase, I don't know, efficiency of training of their workers or something.
I'm really tired of companies having amazing solutions that instead of, you know, doing mass market stuff with it, you know, going to Oculus and saying, okay, let's put it in your device or something. They announce, they hold up that they are so special and they have to sell it to the special guys out there, to the engineers or whatever. And that hurts like everyone themselves because they don't earn as much as they could when they would, you know, push it out. And, you know, on a big scale, and also the whole idea behind it. So, I mean, it's neat that they're showing it, but, I mean, well,
You need to start
every company, make a Kickstarter. I don't know.
Okay, guys, do you not kind of think that eye trackers are kind of going to be a thing? Like, not this time around, but the second generation, like, at least
pretty
the second
sure.
generation.
Pretty
okay.
sure it will.
At least we all agree on that, you know, I don't know what the move SMI is trying to pull with this whole press release thing. I mean, I don't think the tech itself changed from what they had like a year ago, but the only way I actually knew about this SMI eye tracker was through Altspace actually. And they released a small little video like 6 months ago of Altspace actually including eye tracking in their world, and they were using an SMI eye tracker. I was like, oh, what is that? Can I get one? And it was like, nope, pretty expensive. But yeah, it's actually, that's the whole fascinating thing. I think eye tracking, yes, for, you know, performance, everything that it works out really well, but for presence and immersion and for actual feel of another person's gaze is so cool with eye trackers.
Yes.
Even the little video that they put out, we'll link it in the show notes. It's basically two avatars standing around looking at each other and then looking at you, you know, like you and the viewer, and then you see their eyes moving, how they're looking around, they're talking. So it's real. Like that avatar is a fully breathing thing with eyes moving, and it even just seeing eyes has enough to convey emotion through just the body language of the head, the eyes, and the hand. So I think that's where it really takes off, and you feel the feeling of people. So like I was saying, these maybe having sensors within the padding of an HMD could be good for not only eye tracking, if that reach kind of picks up and becomes actually usable, and not only that, but also picking up on facial expressions through just the instead of using a webcam for it, which they've been using till now, actually picking up at the electrical signals of your facial muscles moving through the HMD. Like, think about that. That could be something.
There is actually a project.
There is, right? You're right.
With Oculus.
I met these researchers, I think from Korea. They were doing it with kind of an electrode of just the mouth kind of simulation. But they said the issue that you have with facial expressions with an HMD on is that the HMD itself actually changes your facial configuration, right? Because it pushes down on it. So it's a little bit harder. It's still in a, you know, experimental phase. But things like that is really where it can take off, where actually having your face like as an entity in the game world could be really cool. Right, guys?
Yes.
Leave me out on the leap.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
you're absolutely right. I mean, I think it's super important for the social interaction. I mean, this will be a rendering view and have a higher resolution or better performance. Sure. I mean,
right.
I think we can agree there. But it has to be, you know, supported by the games and the devices, and for that, there have to be a lot of people using it. But most likely we are not the smartest people in the world, and all the guys that are sitting and building HMDs are aware of it, and there might be something coming. Right.
Well, let's move on from eye trackers
to discussions.
Yeah, let's start talking about different research and things that we've been thinking about and how it's kind of relating to VR. Who wants to start with their ideas?
I would say we can start with quickly discussing the Tree VR. Isn't that the stuff that you actually plug there? Training football players?
Oh, Striver.
Oh, Striver, yeah.
Striver, yeah. So these are the guys from Stanford VR. So Jeremy Bales and the PI, from Stanford, he's done a lot of VR research there. This is one of the companies that he's been working on, and it's called Striver. I randomly just, stumbled upon their Twitter page. And it's basically, it's super interesting. They're using 360 video from the game field. So say you've set up a tripod and then you put a 360, ball cam in front of a quarterback on a game field. And they play, they're doing their plays. They even during practice, you're recording whatever it is, a drill. Afterwards, what most football players actually do after a game is they sit down and they watch, video. I think they just call it video. Like they watch the game footage again, and then so they can re-understand what they did, what they can improve on. But again, if you think about it, how different it is for you to embody yourself from a video from 100 foot up looking at you, and you're trying to dissect your own body movements and see what you should have done and what you can be doing. It's not the same as from a first person or from your eye height perspective. They've been using drones actually in the past couple of years, but even that's not the same. So Striver, what they're doing is they're actually recording this game footage for the players, and then afterwards the players actually, instead of having to watch game footage that way and learn and train themselves, they actually are using HMDs and watching the content of what happened in the play through there. And then they're not only that, but they can actually keep quarterbacks need to get very good at pattern recognition of the defense, right? That's, they have to read it on a very on a millisecond kind of level. So if they're using VR, and let's say they're injured and they're sitting in bed and they can't practice, VR is a great way for them to just run the drill 50 times, see where every single defensive player is, and be able to read that quickly. So they're doing really interesting things like that. I thought we should just give them a quick little shout out to bringing research into great real world application and training, and I'm very happy about that. Do you guys know anything else? Can you elaborate on the educational side of VR and how people are using it for trainings? I know the military has been for a while. Have you heard about anything else?
Yes. So when you speak about training in virtual reality, you can go different directions. So first of all, is the one that you described. You watch other people doing something in a very immersive way. Then you can actually build up training machines that you kind of look through. And for example, when you have the Oculus on or any other HMD, you could learn how to weld metal or work with metal. There are some training systems I actually have saw. Then you can have people interacting in virtual reality in a virtual hangar. So let's say there is a company that builds places for planes to be assembled, right? And the problem is those stations needs to be built, and people need to learn how to use them. And after you kind of build them, you need to put people there for a month that they train. But technically, while you're building them, you can teach the people in virtual reality. And in a certain virtual environment, you can obviously have much more gamification, you can more precise measures of movement, and people who are especially working often in fields of, factory mass production, then not everyone can do that because you need to reach a certain flow for that. But if you do it, you're kind of, you know, trying to reach the perfection. And through, you know, augmented reality, virtual reality, you can help people, you know, remeasure what they're doing, you know, gamify it with certain factors. And it's kind of fun in a certain way, you know, it's kind of a game. Then, I mean, you could call rehabilitation in a certain way training, right? You
yeah.
train yourself to be in a, you know, crowd of people. You train yourself to not be afraid of spiders or flying. I mean, teaching itself, so you kind of look at molecules instead of, you know, drawing them on paper, you build them in VR. I think anatomy has been some videos around where children are, you know, digging inside a body in VR, you know, pulling out the organs and looking at them. And
right.
I mean, I guess the imagination can go wild. The question is what's useful. And I mean, if you use it for, you know, entertainment factor in terms of education, like you can right. in anything put more entertainment with VR, right? When it's like education based. The question is whether like in certain special cases, like with this Try VR or Striver or like mm-hmm. any other application, actually gain more out of it, not because it's more fun, but because you get like more information. Like for example, while welding metal, you don't need to, you know, use more metal up, but you can like super precisely, you know, train yourself. Or like in military, you can apparently train yourself to be in foreign grounds, or, you know.
Yeah. No, the military has been doing this for a long time, and just
yeah.
it makes sense. But yeah, now the actual, you know, private sector is picking up on it. One thing I've heard was that there was an elementary classroom that did like a virtual tour of like China together. Mm,
exactly.
But I don't know to what extent, you know, that tech kind of went. Is it just a 360 Google video?
Cardboard. Yeah.
Right. You know, they're all watching the same video together and around each other. Well, I mean, which is kind of interesting. If you're all standing around and you yell out a command like, "Hey, look around, look behind you," you'll see, you know, the whatever this or that, and everybody, you know, has yeah. to do that. And it's interesting. It's I think having presence, let's say like a system that supports like 20 people in the same room and you're all in the same thing, like that could be really interesting when you're all, you know, every single HMD is connected to each other. But it doesn't have to be like education, or I think VR, I think, or AR is going to be very good when it comes to tutorials. Because let's say you know how big YouTube tutorials are now, you can learn how to do things. Like I learned actually so much of my job just through YouTube. Say you have a plumbing kind of tutorial of a plumber doing it in front of you, but through augmented reality, you actually display it right next to you as to like the guy. So it's almost like you actually walk into his body, you step inside so you can like mimic his movements, or even like a ballet kind of tutorial where the woman is in one of the positions, and then you go and you actually stand in the same body, you know, in the same physical space, and then you try to match her body. Things like that kind of reduce the ability, the need to actually transform objects and things in your head from seeing it on a small little video than to act on actual space in front of you, I think could be really good for education. Curious to see where that's going to be going.
Yeah. So another important topic behind all this education and training is mnemotechnics. So mnemotechnics are basically tricks how to improve your skill to memorize things. And with virtual reality, you could very easily exploit that.
I think spatial memory is going to be really exploited with VR, particularly. That's something I've been very interested in. But I don't know. I think it's like, let's say I've talked about this before, about the memory palace that, right, like the popular show, the Sherlock show kind of popularized.
Yep.
It used to be called Method of Loki. And basically it's like, you kind of close your eyes and then you think of like a familiar space that you know, like let's say your house, and then you go and you place bits of information onto surfaces. So like I want to remember this guy's phone number and place it on a wall or something, right? And then you keep walking around the house and then trying to look at access those information. Like you look up on the wall, like what was that? And then basically if you keep doing this over and over again, you're supposed to get better at accessing those informations based on your spatial memory being a lot better than random tidbits of memory. I can't, you know, account, I can't, I haven't done a Method of Loci myself, but like I, maybe some, you know, doing things this way tapping into your spatial memory instead of having to imagine something, to actually do it, you know, in VR and see it, I think could be very promising. So that's where like user interfaces also come in, is that since it's going to be this very spatial environment for you to place elements into, you're going to be doing these things without, basically you won't even have to look at it. You know, like if you look at a skilled person doing a tilt brush on the HTC Vive, I don't think they're really looking at too much of like the button. I mean, you kind of have to look at, you know, what you're pressing on, but like sometimes you can actually just do quick switches and whatnot, and like, you know where things are. So, and that's a lot different than just having a keyboard and a mouse and you actually have to move a cursor around and do things. So the spatialized memory is just going to be very tapped. Even the applications that I'm throwing out there are very elementary, and I think as time goes on, we're going to be a lot smarter with how we use this space around us.
I definitely agree. And speaking further about mnemotechnics and memory, there will be not only spatial memory, but also, you know, that one object is more contrastful than other. One object causes more immersion than other. One is more positive than other.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of those daily things that we experience in our real life, you know? I like
right.
you, so I will remember you 10 years from now. I will have no idea what you talked about in this podcast, but I will remember that there was this ass that talked very nicely. And just only because I liked you, or I liked the
right,
that
right.
you talked.
Absolutely. Emotional memory. Oh, well, emotional memory is the key memory kind of thing.
Exactly.
If you want anyone to remember anything, like, I think I might be spouting off bullshit now, or a little pseudoscientific, but like, if you kind of rank, you know, memory, you know, emotional memory is probably top, and then spatial memory is second. And then like, I'd say like, you know, just normal or abstract memory or names and things are third, and then abstract concept memories or something could be fourth. Names would be last, definitely. Like, names are the hardest to remember.
Yes.
They're super abstract. They're not connected to any tidbit of information. You know, it's just a random string of phonemes that's thrown at you, and you have to kind of remember that. But I think the reason why we have kind of these rankings for these memories and why they work better is because of evolution. Like, it just goes back to how old of a thing that we've evolved. So the spatial memory, you as a creature, you know, back in the day, every creature pretty much has a very good spatial understanding of how to get around or how to get back to their place. So it's something we evolved into way back. Emotional memory is also another evolutionary thing where, you know, if you encounter a tiger, you want to be able that. Leaves a big emotional impact on you, and you want to be able to remember that event so that you don't, you know, fuck up again. So these things really go back, and that's why I'm saying if we tap into those kind of systems, it's a lot more potent of a system. Like that's a lot of room to be played with, and we haven't had the tech to do that until now. Like, so
speaking about the emotional memory, you could create habits in virtual reality, you know, train people to do something very specific in this specific situation, because we are in a very stressful situation, we usually revert to the solution that is like the most basic to us, the most known, even though if we rationally consider it, that we know that it's not going to work. If it's the solution that we have the most trained, so to say, or it's like our habit, then it's the solution that we are going to use. Therefore, we could create stressful situations in virtual reality, and not only test if people are already having this right habit, but that to train them to have this right habit in safe situation. Like, for example, police has in USA has to know how to take out the gun from a holster and aim it. And it's a very distinct habit that you could
They know how to do that really well.
Exactly.
Trust me.
Yeah, and you could recognize a policeman just how he is taking out his gun. So that's an example of those habits that you could train in a safe situation, but still convincing the user that it's a stressful one. And it could be extrapolated to any daily situations. I don't know, you have a student who is very stressed from of exams or speeches, there is an app to test to train speaking.
Yes, yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, what's so it called? We should send
Speech Simulator.
Right.
It has a long, boring title. Actually. So here you have the same situation of a speech where you can't lose anything, but there are still people and they change into some demons there even. So it is actually pretty frightful. And you still need to give a speech.
It's, yeah, I mean, honestly, behavioral change is going to be super interesting to kind of play with. I think that's where VR is really going to be taking off. And that's why educational things are going to be good for it. Training, therapy, even experiences like just changing of behavior is, that's one thing I'm actually writing a proposal for, is to kind of look into, someone was mentioning that, okay, you've had the Star Wars experience, right, with the Sixth Sense controllers, that you pick up these controllers and then there's their lightsabers, and then you're standing in place, and then there's
I've missed that.
Oh, no, that's funny enough, that's my first VR experience at SVVR.
Lucky you.
That was my very first VR experience. That blew my mind. So for those of you who don't know, it's basically just like, it's the old Sixth Sense controllers that you pick up and then they act as lightsabers, and then you can fling them around, and there's a training kind of ball that goes around that shoots lasers at you. It was very cool. So one of the people that was telling me was that he would see people like kind of slouch down, like kind of posture thing. They would come, and then after like even a couple of minutes of playing that experience, they would like, they'll take it off and they'd just look more happy. They'd just look like they would be standing, you know, more straighter up and walking around. So I was like, huh, like VR is actually going to be like, it's such a physical thing. And even if it's a seated VR experience, like I wonder how, if we can measure, you know, how it's actually changing the behavior and the feeling, the body language and the posture of someone, you know, pre and post VR experience. So I'm still in, you know, the very much planning stage. I haven't even written up a fully formal proposal yet. And I'm still pitching it to my PI, but you know, these are the type of things that we should all be thinking about. Like VR is really something that like, it's significant. It's not giving someone a piece of paper to read. It's not even giving them a video to watch. It's a fucking experience. Like,
exactly. And I guess you can nail it down pretty much by seeing how people reacted, let's say, to, you know, computers with DOS. No one understood this, right? So, I mean, you except you would be a geek, you would not get what it is. And then, you know, you saw how many people struggled with PCs, like even with Windows XP and stuff, still people don't really understood how to use it sometimes. And then smartphones came and somehow it became more intuitional, right? So people kind of figure it out. And I mean, right now you give a VR headset to anyone, and I had the, you know, great chance, we'll speak about it a little bit later, but I had a great chance to put it on someone who was like, you know, religious, doesn't care about technology, and she got it. Like, you know, she got instantly what it's about, and she was amazed. Like, it's super intuitional to our brain what the VR headset is doing to you. There is like nothing contra-intuitional per se to it. Like, it's an environment around you, you can look at it. Like, as much as movies became something we are super, you know, nice enjoying, and I mean, maybe your first movie in your life is kind of weird, but you very quickly adopt to it, and nobody hates movies, right? I mean, maybe someone prefers TV shows, or, you know, maybe someone prefers football, you know, watch football, but no one per se hates video. And I think this interaction in terms of, you know, something that your brain totally gets and understands instantly, you know, okay, it's an environment, I can look around, yeah, I get it. I think this is like, you know, something that changed super duper.
Right.
This is why it's so special.
Speaking of like changing behaviors and whatnot, so Nick Yee, I might have talked about, so Nick Yee's was a Stanford, I keep spotting off on all these Stanford researchers, but I guess they're the only ones I kind of know much about. Well, this guy got big about 10 years ago because of the thing called the Proteus effect, and how it changes you wearing a certain, like, you embodying an avatar in a game actually changes your behavior. So the look of the avatar itself is what's changing you. So if the avatar is more attractive, then you end up, your social interactions are more intimate. And if you are taller, actually, your avatar is taller, then you're, like, more aggressive in negotiations and, like, cool little things like that. And So now he has a company called Quantic Foundry, and it's basically, it says he combines social science and data sciences to understand gaming behavior on a large game, on a large scale. So I was actually seeing a tweet from him that he tweeted out like earlier today, and it's about like the different personalities, so the extroversion, conscientiousness, and openness kind of show different gaming personality. So extroverted people, their like main thing is like action and social, and then they have like destruction and excitement and underneath action and competition and community under social. But then conscientious players are more about mastery and achievement of things, and you know, they go more into the strategy and the challenge of whatnot. So like these are kind of things we're understanding about the different personalities of people and the different things. So what if like even the system itself is conscientious of that and or conscious of that and, you know, adapts to the player, or if you want to change the behavior of the player to be different, you know, like you change some variables around. So I don't know, like there's so much potential, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're kind of doing this podcast, honestly, for any viewer that's like out there, you know, game devs, even enthusiasts and whatnot. Like this is the we're facilitating these discussions so that you can kind of get more ideas as to like where you can take things. Like there's so much, I don't want to keep saying this, but like we really know nothing about this tech yet. Like,
yes,
very little. Peter, where are you? Are you around?
Yeah, I'm there.
Oh, or where's Chris then? God, I can't differentiate you guys' sounds. Your voice.
I'm still here.
I think the problem is that we kind of try to improve the sound quality, because the last podcast was, maybe you heard it, a little bit whack, and now we are so quiet, and it's so noiseless that we're not sure if anyone is still there. But we are here. Maybe we can talk about this Proxemics.
Yeah, I can go into that. So this is something I've been kind of reading about through this book called Infinite Realities. Great book, very VR research based and not outdated at all. Actually, it still very much holds true. Authors are Jim Blaskovic from, I believe he's from UC Santa Barbara, and Jeremy Baleson from Stanford. And they just did a comprehensive kind of like VR research book about the social aspects of, or the things about you that translate into VR. And one thing I'm really interested in like social VR, and that really being a driving force for the technology, I kept noticing how in Altspace, I keep using Altspace because that's just like, it's just a good platform that I've been playing with. You can, when you get up to someone very close to their face, it's very unnerving. Like, it is very uncomfortable. I even tried something out, actually. I like put my hand out and shushed someone at their like their mouth, like as a joke, but like, and they did that back to me. It was like, whoa, like it's as big of a violation of your space as it is in real life. Like, you want to punch that person if they someone does that to your face here. Like, it's almost to that magnitude. And so, I mean, these are things that we really have to think about now. Like, you know, when someone pokes you on Facebook, it's like very, it's, you know, it's very disconnected. But when someone's actually poking you in a VR space, like that is a real feeling almost. So the study of Proxemics is actually the study of the distances that people keep between them and strangers, and how that actually changes with how friendly you are with a person or how intimate you are with a person. So quickly here, I can say that like the intimate space between you and like let's say your spouse is between like 0 to 14 inches, right? Like if you're intimate with someone, that's like how close you are. So 14 inches is a little bit over a foot, so a third of a meter for, you know, SI people. So and then it goes on to your personal space, which is from 14 inches to 4 feet, so that's about a meter and a little bit more. And then after that, a social space, which goes out to, I think, 10 feet, and then it's a public after that. So I'm thinking, what if we actually have certain kind of proxemic filters in social environments so that strangers can't just come up to your face like that and like really make you uncomfortable? Like, what if you kind of have to grant access to someone to come and be very intimately close to you? And that, you know, that can work out through friending someone in AltSpace or following them or whatnot. Like, there's a couple of, you know, interesting things like that that should be considered. And I was just doing, like, basically I was doing this for my portfolio to just put ideas down. And Jeremy Bailyn's, the book kind of covers it a little bit, but they don't really talk. They've done some research, actually, about how it's still a very real feeling that you have. Like, if someone is told that that avatar that they're looking at is not a real person, then they get very close to it. They look at it from every angle and whatnot. But if they tell them that's a real, so the terms that they use is like agent and avatar. An agent is like a fake person. It's like not a real human being. And an avatar is like there's an actual person that's, you know, controlling that avatar. If you tell them that the person they're looking at is an avatar, then they keep that social boundary. They don't get that close. Like, they know they don't want to violate the person's place. So these are very real intrinsic things within us that we have. So I think you really have to be mindful and design around that. Azad, what do you guys think? Yeah.
Do you have some results on how those boundaries change in crowd or in tight spaces?
So I was thinking about that because, yes, you do have to kind of give up those boundaries when you are in a subway. Like, you know, you are so close to each other, but they're still very much like that, even though the boundaries change and they shrink and, you know, and they expand a lot, but there's still always something that, you know, if someone's standing a bit too close to you, like, let's say you're in a bus full of five people and someone comes up and sits next to you, you still feel violated, or not violated, but you feel uncomfortable. Like, why is this guy sitting next to me now when there's this many spaces versus when there's 10 people, there's like a little bit more space. And so, like, it's a very flexible boundary in that sense. So I think maybe
by the way, short notice, it's also dependent on the cultural background you have.
That's absolutely correct. And so obviously the research was only conducted in America, but they did state that it's, yeah, you know, that it's actually America is kind of one of the wider, the boundaries are kind of wider than other cultures.
Exactly. Like, I guess if you go to, I don't know, Cuba or Mexico, you might get mm-hmm. way closer.
Yeah, I mean, even I can think of my family, like Armenians, we're all touchy-feely, you know, we're like, get up to you, slap your back, like, Habibi, like...
Exactly. I'm just like, sometimes super strange for people who are not, you know, used to it.
Yeah.
But then I guess you perceive you as, you know, you living in Armenia and you come for the first time in the US, like the US guy would perceive you as, you know, kind of violating his space, and you would perceive him as cocky or, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Like, think of Borat and how, like, why that's such a funny movie.
Yes.
Because of personal spaces that's being violated, like the proxemics thing.
Exactly.
So, like I'm saying, we're doing this podcast so that we can really bring light to these issues that we've really not had to think about before. You know, like, literally the idea of personal space in a software. It's
I have to admit, before you like talk today about it, I didn't neither think about it nor did I really read anywhere anyone being really concerned about it. I mean, you kind of have, you know, those messaging stuff, and okay, you can block people on Twitter, mm-hmm. but I guess maybe in Second Life they had in a certain way those issues, like I mean, there are those also like more pornographic games where you can, you know, like interact with each other, and I guess it's also super strange if other people are watching you there, like, I don't know, and if you're trying to chat with someone, you know, get to know someone, I mean, how hard is it to just write someone a message on Facebook, but then you're standing in the room and there's the other person, you're approaching him and you're talking to him.
Yeah, real consequences. There's absolutely real consequences.
Exactly.
And that's one of the fun things to do, is like to really play with those boundaries in VR and see how far you can take that. You know, it's
yes,
you could call it a troll, but like, let's just say we're doing it for science, like.
Yes. Yes. Okay. But see, it's not just your text that you're writing, but your voice is being heard, so you're kind of more recognizable. So even if your nickname is like super anonymous, you're kind of there, and you kind of link your body to that experience there, or your mind, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's real, man. No, it's absolutely real.
I mean, maybe cyberbullying will be, you know, something.
No, absolutely. That's why I mean, like, that's why we need these privacy filters, is definitely. Because once it becomes big enough and they say, like, you have these worlds are populated more, you can totally harass someone. Like, I mean, that's actually one of the first things I got the true. When I was in an HTC Vive and I was in alt space and I was, like, standing face to face with this woman from Japan. And I was like, honestly, that's probably one the most immersive thing I've felt was that's why I'm so into social VR now, is because that is what really put me in the world. And I, whenever the demo person took off the Vive from my head, I just like was teleported right back. I was like, holy cow, like this was something else. So I was standing face to face with her and I was speaking to each other, and like I think I got a little bit too close to her face and she backed up. Like she's like, whoa there, like what are you doing? I'm like, huh, oh, you can do that? And so I, you know, I had my the controllers were in my hand, so I poked her and she's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm just, you know, just messing around. Like, she was getting a little uncomfortable. And then after a couple of minutes, like a third person walked into our conversation and we both looked at him like, who are you and why are you, you know, in our conversation? Like,
yeah,
you know, you so you have these, this personal space and boundary is definitely something that will be or needs to be thought and designed around. And what I'm trying to do is kind of set down the groundwork for it so that, you know, other developers can start building off of it. I don't think the boundaries that we have right now, you know, the whole 14 inches to 4 feet, like I think those are very just normal, just research based. And I think those boundaries are very flexible. So,
yes,
but
well, the solution is simple. You have bars in the menu or the window where you can type in the number, and then yes. Everybody can have their own boundaries, but my boundary override your boundary of you coming to me.
Okay, Chris, but this implies that you actually go into settings. So, I mean, if you want to provide the most natural feeling, I mean, you kind of can twitch it a little bit later, but you kind of want to have, you know, perfect settings there. So you cannot, like, walk through someone. Right. I guess what is super strange if I stand there and someone walks through me because there is no clipping or something.
Hmm.
This would be super weird.
There's a couple of things I've been thinking about is also it's not a perfect circle that goes around you. Like you're not as aware behind you. So exactly. Maybe it should be more of a semicircle. But you know, then you could run into some logic errors. Like if someone is standing behind you in your intimate zone and then you turn around, like what happens? Did they get bounced? You know, do they get bounced off of your boundary, like that they're already in?
No, but see, if you're like in public transportation, I mean, you and US don't have too much public transportation, as I noticed.
Yeah,
like travel a lot in cities like Berlin here, you use a lot of public space. And like, if someone is standing behind you, they can be, you know, very close to you, but in front of you, no one will stand next to you face to face, right? They will feel also kind of uncomfortable. So like if you turn or you know, you turn to your back and see someone standing behind you, but also with his back to you, well, it's fine. But if you're turning around, right, his face is directly in your face. This is kind of strange.
Maybe the simplest way to start it is have only one certain boundary. And let's say the intimate zone, you really can't, you shouldn't let people go in there unless you actually grant them access. Like, exactly. I think that's probably the simplest way to do this right now. Because it's actually really hard, even if you do allow someone in there, it's that intimate zone is still a very hard place to converge your eyes onto. So, and that's kind of even a physical pain. So we'll just have, that should just be a thing around players, that nothing should be coming into that. No, Mike Algers actually has his little thing where he calls it the no-go zone. And he said no content should be there because it's really hard to converge your eyes onto a thing that small. Big shout out to Mike Algers, actually. He's done a lot of interesting research. He did a master's thesis on the content, how to display content in VR, essentially, and how, you know, using degrees of your head moving, you know, 70 degrees, you can move your head without strain, and then 20 extra 20% to go to 180 to that's straining your head. And so just basically different ways of, or different places that you should be displaying your content so that it's, you're not just emulating a 2D screen into a 3D space. Like you're actually designing in a 3D environment.
Yeah. Maybe last thing that I want actually to plug that is very interesting. Let me go to Kickstarter. and log in, because it kind of fits right now. It's not too perfect fit, but you know, let me quickly see. Have you seen this project where they were trying to sell a 360 degree interactive movie on Kickstarter?
No, I'm not sure.
Well, wait. It's actually quite cool. But first, how do I figure out on Kickstarter what I actually start? projects. No, I found it. Yes. It's called Blackout. I will send you a link. It's very interesting out of many reasons. So, I mean, I just was a little bit stupid and said in the US you don't really use public transportation. Well, you do in New York, right? You have.
I even use it in Santa Cruz here to get to school. Like, I got a bus.
Sure. So, I mean, it's just not as common as here. But no, absolutely. You obviously also have it there. I think the project is over, but what they had is it was a very innovative way to film it. So they developed, I think, their own holder for the Kinect, which was holding the Kinect and a DSLR camera. And what they were being able to film is like a person moving, and you could like really film from every side, and you could reconstruct the person dancing, moving, sitting, like in a virtual environment. So the metro they have there is virtual, but the people sitting there are actually real people that they filmed.
Right. So they track their body positioning and then recreate an avatar. Okay.
No. They didn't track it. They recorded. They recorded a depth
like a UV mapping. Right. Okay.
Yes.
Like, so that's photogrammetry. Kind of territory.
Yeah, kind of. Yes. So they basically have, like, you can what you're being capturing, what you capture with the Kinect are depth information, right? And you kind of get a mesh out of it, and they have kind of the mesh of you, and then instead of just, you have the mesh, and then the information about color is being filmed with the camera that is good. And if you see, we will also link it. It looks kind of funky, but it's very interesting, so it's very artistic. But what happens is you're stuck, and this is why it's called Blackout, and you can walk as a person through this train part, and like whenever you come to someone close, you hear their thoughts. That's why it's called Glimpse into Their Lives of Strangers, right? They start to hear their thoughts or something. That's very interesting. Like, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Exactly. I see we're running up on an hour and hour and a half, guys.
Exactly.
We should go to our closing thoughts.
Yes.
So you should go ahead, Peter. What kind of do you have any closing thoughts you want to throw out before we close the show?
Well, first of all, to anyone listening, you see we are developing, we are moving forward, we are being more structured and better prepared, and it will continue. We are just starting, so soon our website will launch, or is launching right now, or is launched when you're listening to it.
Hopefully.
That means, we are working on it. Unfortunately, when you want to make a proper podcast, there are a lot of things you need to think of, like you have to have a proper feed and a lot of software catalogs need to list you there, and you kind of want to make sure that the download is working and everything is right. Mm-hmm. Because we are very serious about it, as you see, and we can't wait the moment where actually people are listening to it and we get feedback, because, you know, maybe we are wrong with something or you know it better. That means whenever you have any feedback you want to provide, just write it in the commentary section, which soon will be there, or it is there when you're listening to it. We are looking forward. Next time we will speak about the target audience. Chris has some very interesting thoughts on it that he will present to you. We might catch the topic of 3D audio, and pretty sure that in the next few episodes we will get very exciting guests, which we will dedicate a certain topic to.
Yeah, that sounds awesome, actually.
Next sec. Chris?
Most likely it will also true through CES news during the next episode.
Yeah, so CES is happening right now, and we're reporting on the VR stuff, but we'll do a wrap-up of CES next show. Cool, very cool. Also, guys, I will be attending VR LA next. I think in January 27 or so. It's basically that weekend. It's 23, then January 23, and it's just a cool little expo that they're doing. It's like bigger than their meetup, and it's like
can
the best
VR
expo. Can
you just do some interviews with your phone? I will post process it.
Ooh, yeah. We'll let's talk about that actually.
Because with an iPhone you can record it fine, and when you throw it to iPhone or to the software, it will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, listen to some examples. That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. No, we can definitely do things like that.
Nice.
And yeah, all right, everybody. Chris, do you have any closing thoughts?
No, I'm impatient to wait for CES announcements.
Yeah, absolutely.
I will have any more comments after that.
Well, I have to admit, as long as it will not be like this super amazing electric car they announced, what was it called? If you saw it?
Oh, the Faraday Future?
Future, what the fuck?
I was watching it yesterday.
Like, what the fuck is that? It's one car.
I have no idea, honestly. No idea.
Who? Or what have been smoking, what kind of things that they decided, okay, we were going to show this car. Like, it's amazing, but what the fuck?
I need to do more research on it, because I was watching the live stream yesterday and I didn't understand anything that they were trying to hit. I mean, I have no idea.
Yes, it gets, you know, 3 seconds, 60 miles per, so it's super amazing, but it will cost a fortune. Right.
Like we said, building hardware is hard, guys. Hardware is hard.
Yeah, don't forget to order your Oculus.
Yeah, don't forget.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Alrighty, everyone. Until next time, this is Shovel VR.